is there, but it's not sufficient to defeat the Islamic State, to my mind. And the Islamic State's many enemies are all there, but they're disunited, and they distrust and hate each other almost as much, or if not more, than they hate the Islamic State.
Patrick Coburn, we want to thank you for being with us, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. His latest book, The Rise of Islamic State, ISIS and the New Sunni Revolution. We'll link to your article. Private donors from Gulf oil states helping to bankroll salaries of up to 100,000 ISIS fighters. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is the evening news.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO is one of the local co-sponsors of the Economics of Happiness Conference, Friday evening, February 27th to Sunday, March 1st in Portland. The conference is a place to connect with the global localization movement, communities challenging dominant systems of power as they build more sustainable and resilient social and economic relationships. The program will include plenaries, panels, interactive workshops, and other participatory sessions. International, national, and local activists will mix and share projects and experiences. Speakers will include conference co-founder Helena Norberg Hodge, Jerry Mander, and Charles Eisenstein. Again, that's the Economics of Happiness Conference next weekend, February 27 to March 1st, at the Elliott Center, 1211 Southwest Main Street in downtown Portland. More information can be found at localfutures.org or our own website, kboo.fm, on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from February 28th through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music. PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Federal Communications Commission rules in favor of net neutrality.
Right here in Washington County, Oregon, moves are ahead with plans to close the last two health clinics available to provide care to undocumented workers.
And the city of Troutdale is considering dissolving its police department in order to save money.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 26th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sari Gametha. A man was found dead after Portland police pursued and surrounded him early Wednesday morning in a southeast neighborhood. Quintrell Shaman Holliman, 26, died from an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound after a massive police mobilization chased him into a residence fenced yard where he was found dead. The incident began when Officer Stephen Wilburn and Sergeant Ken Duilio arrived at Shimmer's Bar and Grill on 80th and Foster. Holliman exited the bar and, after being confronted by the officers, ran off while firing at Officer Wilburn. After cornering Holliman in the residence backyard, police spokespeople used megaphones to try and convince Holliman to come out and surrender. They also used apparently non-lethal bullets and at least one flashbang grenade to subdue him. Holliman was affiliated with Portland's Hoover Gang and had escaped from a halfway house after serving 33 months in prison for possessing a firearm illegally. Both officers have been placed on paid leave as a standard protocol after a fatal incident such as this.
A 16-year-old student who was tased and brutalized by Portland police last September had a court hearing today at the Juvenile Justice Center. Judge Diana Stewart presided over the hearing, and according to a Portlander who attended the hearing, ruled that Officer Hornstein's decision to stop the 16-year-old was unjustified. After a video of the incident was posted on Facebook, Police Chief Mike Reese said that the Bureau's Professional Standards Division would review the incident. But 4 months later, no review has been made public and no one knows the status of that review. In the incident last September, Portland police showed up in force with multiple cars and officers when two homeowners called the police to complain about a group of teenagers gathered in the neighborhood around midnight on a Saturday. When the police arrived, they began questioning 16-year-old Ty Gurul, who asked why he was being targeted. The police are seen on tape hitting the 16-year-old and then tasing him, despite no indication that the teenager was resisting. A group of people who gathered around the scene began to question the police behavior. One of those who complained, 20-year-old Giovanni Dimitri Gurul, said that police had targeted his little brother for no reason and that they should take him instead. Eventually, the police did take Giovanni into custody and released his 16-year-old brother, Ty. Both Ty and his older brother, Giovanni, faced charges, but none of the police officers involved have faced any charges or reprimands from the police department.
The city of Troutdale is seriously considering dissolving its police department and shifting law enforcement services to the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Mayor Doug Doust says the new approach would save the city $500,000 per year and give the city's 16,000 residents access to more diverse police services. He also said that there is broad support from City Council and the current police department. The Troutdale Police Department's 27 police officers and employees would be blended into the Multnomah Sheriff's Office, but still work from the existing Troutdale Police Building. If the city took this step, they would be joining Maywood Park and Wood Village, both of which have foregone their departments in order to contract services from the Sheriff's Department. In Washington County, Cornelius has chosen a similar route. With the new plan, there would be 16 officers operating in Troutdale during any 24-hour period. The Troutdale City Council will hear details on March 3rd and hold a vote on March 24th.
A 78-year-old woman in Fresno, California, is suing Clovis Unified School District after being brutally assaulted by a school police officer. Mary Poole was delivering cupcakes and a box of cookies to her granddaughters at the school when she was told by the officer that there was a restraining order against her and that she needed to leave the campus. This was actually not true. There was no such restraining order, but Poole obeyed the officer and left the school. She then pulled her car over about a block away in order to call her son about the incident. The officer followed her and demanded again that she leave, despite the fact that she was no longer on school grounds. When Poole protested, the officer immediately became confrontational and sprayed her with mace twice. He then dragged her from her vehicle, threw her to the ground, dislocating her shoulder. Mary Poole, who is barely over 5 feet tall and weighs about 110 pounds, was then dragged along the ground by the officer back to the school, which broke several of her bones. After an extensive hospital visit, $180,000 in medical bills, Poole is filing suit against the school district for police brutality and elderly abuse.
The Washington County Board of Commissioners voted Tuesday to close the two remaining public health clinics in the county located in Beaverton and Hillsboro. KBOO's Sam Bowman has more on this story.
The plan to shut down Washington County's last two public health clinics in Beaverton and Hillsboro was first proposed by Health and Human Services Director Marnie Kyle last year. No public hearing was held on the plan until 6:30 Tuesday night, directly before the vote. Under the plan, the clinic services limited to STD testing and treatment, women's reproductive health, tuberculosis testing, and vaccinations will be picked up by other local providers, and many of the clinic's uninsured patients will have a better opportunity to get primary care. As previously reported by KBOO, many advocates for farm laborers and immigrants working in Washington County are worried that the closures will make it more difficult for the clinic's patients, most of whom are very low income, to continue receiving care. Four members of the five-member board were present, and around 28 people spoke to them at the hearing, with the vast majority coming down against closing the clinics. Among the speakers were representatives of Virginia Garcia and Planned Parenthood, two of the providers who will provide services when the clinics close. They confirmed their ability to provide those services while calling into question some of the assumptions of the plan.
My name is Kara McEachern. I am a Washington County resident and also the manager of the Beaverton Planned Parenthood. I actually do support the transition, but I think there is a lot of talk about primary care, and that's not what's at risk here. Family planning services are arguably the most critical piece of preventive care, and access to those services is the critical piece of family planning. So, as we talk about primary care and getting all of the residents in Washington County a medical home, we also need to consider that not all residents are looking for a medical home. And those residents who are accessing services at the county are accessing a very narrow scope of services that is available at Planned Parenthood, and those services can't see a gap in the provision, because any gap in providing these services to our most vulnerable populations will raise the risk of unintended pregnancy, will create negative health outcomes for our community. So while I appreciate the conversation surrounding primary care, my main concern is that family planning services are available to everybody who needs it in the way that they can access it.
One of the speakers was Lil Reitzel, a nurse at one of the clinics.
So my concern is really that closing the clinics as of June 30th is not going to have enough time to sufficiently get input from the concerned parties and implement a plan that actually I will be able to tell someone where they can get their birth control. As of now, I can't tell someone that.
About 150 people were packed into the room, many carrying signs that said, "Don't shut down our health clinics," "Stop balancing the budget on the poor," and "Why give tax breaks to corporations and cut public health?" A number of people were there from the Western Farm Workers Association, which has been fighting the planned closures since last September. I spoke with Leisha Anderson, the group's operations director, about their experience with the county's approach to the plan and stakeholder outreach.
Our experience, both as, you know, the Western Farm Workers, but also the Committee for Healthcare Equity and the members of our association and nurses and social workers who've been part of that, is that from the very beginning, we were told the clinics are shutting down, we're moving forward on this. And no matter, you know, the opposition to the clinics shutting down has been expressed as concerns, but it's a lot more than concerns. It's opposition. And the Committee for Healthcare Equity has, from the beginning, said that Washington County needs to take a ways and means approach to funding public health, and they should not be cutting funding that's currently going to keep the clinics open and using it for other priorities in health and human services. If they have other priorities in health and human services, they need to pursue additional funding from the county. This is not a poor county. There are many industries here, many resources, and that the county should be fighting for the funds that they need, but that has not been the approach. The approach has been, to our experience and the experience of others we've spoken to, has been, this is the plan, we're moving forward, we're shutting down the clinics, now it's just, we're working out the details.
The hearing went on from 6:30 to almost 10 at night, and was followed immediately by Chairman Andy Dyke calling a vote.
Okay, there are no other additional comments. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the motion passes 4-0. Thank you all for coming out. You expressed some very important concerns, and I know we have fully addressed all of them, and we will do our best to do so. Everyone's at work for July 1st.
When you were talking to the public against, and they ignore all of that, one guy who gets money for more people going in the hospitals, they ignore him.
Nobody's
going to
talk about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you look in the mirror?
This is what supremacy looks like. Black people with power always seem to win.
The clinics will close for good on June 30th of this year, with transitional services beginning the next day. For KABU Evening News, this is Sam Bowman.
Oregon's smoke-free workplace law prohibits smoking in public places and workplaces, but the law currently exempts electronic cigarettes and vaporizers. The Multnomah County Commission is reported to be considering whether to extend the ban to include those products. Some local businesses and e-cigarette users want vaporizer stores excluded from the ban. They organized a protest at the foot of the Hawthorne Bridge today to call attention to the issue. KABU's Doug McVeigh spoke with some of the protesters to find out more.
I'm David Glenn. I'm the vice president of the Multnomah County Vaping Association.
Okay, and so tell me about your protest here today.
We're trying to get attention to the fact that vape shops rely on the ability to have vaping within the retail stores. The commissioners are looking to pass a new policy that includes electronic cigarettes in the smoke-free workplace ban, so which we support, and it keeps minors away from the electronic cigarettes, also prevents sales and all that. We totally support what they're doing. We're looking for an exemption for the vape shops because our business model requires people to actually be able to vape within the vape shop, and we're trying to get our message out on that one. We want to work with the commissioners, continue forward with the proposals that they have that they want to push forward, but we want consideration for the 33 businesses that we represent in our association, and nearly 200 employees that have jobs that depend on the ability for people to sample electronic cigarettes inside the actual store to see if it works for them. And we help people get off of cigarettes. We help people switch over to something that's a little less harmful to them. And without, if this goes through without an exemption for vape shops, it could potentially put us out of business.
Okay, and just to clarify, this is a Multnomah County, the county commission is looking at that here?
Yes, Multnomah County-wide, they are forwarding a policy that's going to include electronic cigarettes into the work-free or smoke-free workplace act, which means whereas you can't smoke at work, you wouldn't be able to vape. And we don't really have a problem with that. That's not something we oppose. We just need an exemption for vape shops. The retailers of electronic cigarettes expressly focusing on electronic cigarettes as a retail business. We need them to be exempt or this will put them out of business.
Right on. Now, do you know, are there any other counties that are looking at a similar measure? Also, I haven't seen anything at the state, but do you have anything around there?
A lot of, nationwide, a lot of counties and states are already trying to look at similar legislation. In Washington, Oregon itself, there are a lot of bills being passed right now or being discussed in Salem, where the very similar act, the Clean Air Act, would include electronic cigarettes into it, and we're trying to get an exemption for vape shops at the state level also. And that's something that the Northwest Vapor Association, who represents businesses all throughout Oregon, they're taking up that cause down in Salem for us.
Okay, great. Anything else you want to let the listeners know?
Yeah, vapor's not smoke, and that's something that needs to be distinguished. People are not taking up vapor to create a new addiction. We are trying to help people get off of an addiction that they already have, which is cigarettes and tobacco. We are not to big tobacco. We are very specifically against tobacco products. We want people to be able to get away from it. Every one of us here at one point smoked. Electronic cigarettes saved our lives and helped us get off of cigarettes, and that's what we try to help other people do.
People want to find out more, where do they go?
SaveTheVapeShops.org.
Okay, and your name, sir?
My name is Paul Bates. I'm the president of the Multnomah County Vaping Association.
Have you folks tried to meet directly with the commissioners yet to discuss your concerns?
I have managed to meet with two of the commissioners, Jules Bailey from District 1 and Deborah Kafuri, who's the chair of the Multnomah County Commission. And they seemed somewhat receptive to the idea that we need to exempt the vape shops from this indoor smoke-free workplace act that they're considering right now. Unfortunately, they haven't been able to give me any confirmation that they're actually going to do that. So we're out here today to try to bring the public in, make them aware how much this will affect them. Banning vaping in vape shops will lead to an unintended consequence and align the county on the side of big tobacco. It will drive more people to smoke, more people to die, and it simply is a job killer and killer of people. Vaping has been proven to be safer than smoking. How much safer is the only unknown at this point? Hundreds of times safer? 50 times safer? 1,000 times safer? We simply don't know that yet, but we do know absolutely that vaping is safer than smoking, and that secondhand vapors do not harm bystanders. Not even the most virulent anti-vaping, anti-e-cigarette proponents have suggested that secondhand vapor has any effect whatsoever on bystanders. And it's simply exempting the vape shops will add some balance to this ordinance, save jobs, and save lives.
And again, to clarify, you are talking about an exemption for the vape shops where people are coming in to look at and possibly purchase some of the equipment as opposed to, say, bars or other workplaces.
Absolutely. Those spaces don't need to vape. In the vape shop, we do a lot of work diagnosing people's equipment, finding out, keeping them on track with vaping rather than smoking. The diagnostics is just really critical. These devices can get very complicated, and teaching people is half of our job. And then the taste testing and demonstrating different products so they can make the right choice, find the product that suits them, is absolutely important. Rather than sending them out onto the street, sending them home with no hands-on instructions, it's just a recipe for failure, and it supports big tobacco.
All right, well, thank you very much. This is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
Students at the University of Oregon will soon have easier access to a vaccine that claims to protect them from a deadly strain of meningitis. The new vaccine will provide some protection against the type B strain of meningitis that has caused a recent outbreak at the university. The outbreak started in January and has resulted in the death of one student and infected several more. Vaccines for other strains of meningitis have been available for years, but this is the first to protect against type B, the most common strain of meningitis found in the Pacific Northwest. Students at the University of Oregon are considered at very high risk because of the recent outbreak. University officials say they are trying to make it as easy as possible for students to get the new vaccine. They promise short wait times, snacks, and assistance with billing insurance. The campus is even offering free shots for those who qualify. Risk factors for contracting meningitis include being in a fraternity or sorority, spending time in bars, and having more than one intimate partner.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. Tonight, KBOO's Paul Rowland speaks with Flint Taylor from Chicago about the recently revealed secret off-the-books enhanced interrogation centers. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock, and at 7 it'll be Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Stay tuned at 8 o'clock for Guess Who's Coming to Radio, with a focus on the nature of language in relation to this week's commemorations of W.E.B. Du Bois and Malcolm X. Tomorrow's weather will be the usual: partial clouds, 60% chance of rain, a high of about 52, but a low of about 36 in the morning. Today in history, in 1815, Napoleon escaped from exile on the island of Elba, only to be defeated for good a few months later at the Battle of Waterloo. And in 1917, the original Dixieland Jazz Band released the first jazz record called Livery Stable Blues. The quote of the day is from Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuściński. These are paradoxes no tyrant can deal with. The scythe swings, and at once the grass starts to grow back. Cut again, and the grass grows faster than ever. A very comforting law of nature.
It is 5:24 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Whenever a corporation issues a statement declaring that it is committed to, quote, treating consumers fairly and with respect, chances are it's not. After all, if the outfit was actually doing it, there would be no need for a statement. Indeed, this particular claim came from Encore Capital, one of our country's largest buyers of bad consumer debt. And it definitely has not been playing nice with the people it browbeats to collect overdue credit card bills, car loans, etc. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman found that Encore, based in San Diego, filed nearly 240,000 lawsuits against debtors in a recent four-year period, using our courts as its private collection arm. Problem is, Encore's bulk filing of lawsuits are rife with errors, out-of-date payment data, fabricated credit card statements, etc. Tons of them are missing original loan documents, payment histories, and other proof of debt. Debt predators, however, scoot around this lack of facts by simply having their employees sign affidavits asserting that the level of money owed is accurate. Judges, overwhelmed by the unending flood of lawsuits filed by Encore et al., have accepted those affidavits as true, thus ruling in favor of the corporations. But Schneiderman found that, surprise, affidavits were simply being rubber-stamped by company employees who didn't have time to check for accuracy. An employee of one large debt buyer testified that he was having to sign about 2,000 affidavits a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is no minor scam. 1 in 7 adults in the U.S. is under pursuit by debt collectors. It's hard enough for struggling families to claw their way out from under the economic crash without having lying, cheating, predator corporations twist the court system to pick their pockets and shut off their hope of recovery.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
The East Coast of the United States has been experiencing an extremely cold winter for the second year in a row. Climate scientists have linked this weather pattern to an increasingly erratic jet stream, which is in turn linked to the massive ice melt up in the Arctic. Jennifer Francis is a professor at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. She spoke today with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about the impact of human-induced climate change on the Arctic and how that is creating more severe weather patterns, particularly here in North America.
My research involves the connection of rapid Arctic warming to the jet stream, which is a very different thing. It's this fast-moving river of air over our heads that creates and steers all of the weather that we feel down here on the surface. And the connection there, getting back to your question, is that our research suggests that as the Arctic is warming so fast, it's causing the jet stream to meander more as it travels around the northern hemisphere. So normally it goes all the way around the northern hemisphere, but it swings to the north and it dips to the south. But what we're seeing is an increase in the size of these waves in the jet stream. And the reason that's important is because when those waves get really large, which is exactly the situation we're in right now, they tend to move very slowly from west to east, and that results in our weather being very persistent, the same conditions day after day after day. And that is exactly what we've been experiencing all across the country this winter and last winter, for that matter.
And here in the Pacific Northwest, we've had an extremely warm and dry winter for what it normally is here, which is cold and rainy. Is there an impact from the jet stream on our weather out here?
Absolutely. So if you could picture a map of North America, what the jet stream is doing is taking a big northward swing up towards Alaska. and covering most of the west coast of North America, and then it jumps or it swings down into the middle of the country and takes a big southward dip over the eastern half of the U.S. and Canada. And the reason that's important is because that jet stream really is the boundary between the warm air to the south and the cold air to the north. So when it swings north of you, you're in the warm air. And when it dips south of you, like is occurring over most of the east, then all the Arctic air is able to plunge southward. So they're both of these very unusual weather conditions that have been going on for so long are completely connected to each other.
And have you been able to make any longer-term predictions as to what the impact of continued Arctic ice melt will be?
Well, we think that this tendency for the jet stream to take these very wavy patterns is probably going to increase. We can't say that every year is going to be like this year or like last year, but the tendency, we think, will be for these very wavy jet stream patterns to increase in frequency. It's hard to say right now where exactly they're going to situate themselves, so whether the east will be cold or and the west warm or vice versa, but there is possibly some prediction available because of the way the sea surface temperature patterns in the Pacific are shaping up. And right now, they're in a pattern that tends to favor the jet stream condition that we're in at the moment.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Francis. She is a research professor at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A ruling this morning by the Federal Communications Commission to protect net neutrality has been praised as a victory by internet activists. Although the debate about how best to protect net neutrality may have concluded this morning with the FCC's new rules to govern the internet, some activists say that the battle may have only just begun. The Subcommittee on Commerce and Technology, which is chaired by Oregon Republican Greg Walden, met Wednesday. At the meeting, Walden conveyed his fears that the designation of the internet as a utility will inspire a wave of litigation challenging that classification. According to the website Open Secrets, a product of the Center for Responsive Politics, Walden has received more than $1.6 million from the communications and electronics sector over the course of his career. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan discussed today's announcement and what internet users can expect going forward with an attorney on staff at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
I'm talking with Mitch Stoltz. He is a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I know that you guys have taken a leading role in the battle for net neutrality. Your response to the FCC's announcement this morning about invoking Title II provisions to protect the internet.
We're very happy that the FCC listened to the voice of the internet community, which I think has said loud and clear over the past year that we need a set of rules of the road, a set of net neutrality rules that are effective and that are easy for everyone to understand.
I've seen some commentary from Congress this morning expressing their disappointment in this set of rules. Can you explain why they're disappointed and what they fear?
To be honest, I think there are some members of Congress really trying very hard to make net neutrality a partisan wedge issue. It doesn't need to be, and it isn't necessarily. What they are worried about, and frankly we share this worry, is unbounded and unpredictable overregulation. And there is a piece of the new rules, as we understand them, you know, that does cause us a little bit of concern, and that's that there is something called a general conduct rule, which seems kind of open-ended and something that the FCC could use selectively or unpredictably in the future.
Does it remain within Congress's purview to go ahead and develop legislation that could offset the FCC's new rules?
Absolutely. Congress always has the final say on these rules. But given Congress's inability to do much of anything in the past several years, I don't foresee a major change here. Now, it could happen, but it's unlikely.
It seems the concern is about a, quote, stampede to the courts, creating an atmosphere of uncertainty that could last decades. Do you anticipate legal action by internet providers?
I think that's quite possible. Certainly the last three versions of the FCC's open internet rules have been challenged in court. This one probably will be too. No, I think it'll survive.
Now, I think everybody was watching quite specifically for the Title II provisions. Can you talk about the rules as it pertains to municipal broadband and what are the biggest changes there?
That's an area we really don't know too much about yet, and we're not really clear how that rule will work or whether the legal basis for it is sound, but it's a goal we support. It is referring to basically a couple of states. The action this morning just concerned two states. I think they were North Carolina and Tennessee, but there are similar laws in other states that were basically prevented municipalities from setting up their own broadband infrastructures. Where places where they have done that, like in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and there are a few others, they often do a much better job than the monopolist ISPs, and for lower cost.
Let folks know more about the work that your organization does and where they can go for more information about this important set of rules that came out today.
Sure. EFF is a nonprofit, member-supported civil liberties organization. We promote the idea that when you go online, the Bill of Rights should go with you. And we work on those goals in Congress and in the courts and through grassroots activism. And anyone wanting to know more can go to EFF.org. We have a very lively blog, or you can follow us on Twitter as well.
I've been talking with Mitch Stoltz. He is a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. For more information, you can visit their website at EFF.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
United States Attorney Loretta Lynch is one step closer to becoming the new Attorney General. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted to approve her nomination earlier today. The vote was 12-8 in favor. Three Republicans, Senators Orrin Hatch, Lindsey Graham, and Jeff Flake, sided with Democrats on the committee in voting to send Ms. Lynch's nomination to the full Senate for approval. That Senate vote is expected to occur sometime in the next couple of weeks. It is expected that Ms. Lynch will be confirmed, making her the first African-American woman to become United States Attorney General.
Marijuana possession is officially legal today in the District of Columbia, in spite of the objections of some members of Congress. Voters in Washington, D.C. overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure last fall to legalize personal possession and cultivation of marijuana by people over 21. Some right-wing members of Congress tried to block it by attaching a rider to the massive appropriations bill that was passed back in December. D.C. officials stood up to Congress and declared that the measure would go into effect regardless of congressional interference. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, several city council members, the D.C. Attorney General, and the Chief of Police held a news conference on Wednesday to discuss the new law.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Muriel Bowser, and I am the duly elected mayor of the District of Columbia. And we know that the residents of the District of Columbia spoke loud and clear last November 4th when they adopted Initiative 71 to legalize small amounts of marijuana in Washington, D.C. And we are, our government is prepared to implement and enforce Initiative 71 in the District of Columbia. In keeping with the opinions of our Attorney General, we believe, of course, that 71 was self-enacted, was enacted on December the 5th when our Board of Elections approved the initiative. And we have been working to make sure that we clarify and inform our agencies and the residents of the District of Columbia what that means. Let me repeat again, as I did yesterday, what Initiative 71 allows. It allows for the home use and home growth of marijuana. It does not allow for the sale of marijuana, the use or consumption of marijuana in public spaces, and the use of marijuana by juveniles. That means people under the age of 21 is illegal. While used by adults will be legal under these limited circumstances, we continue to recognize that marijuana is a controlled substance that should be used safely and responsibly by adults. And all of the agencies of our government have been tasked with making sure that they understand what the rules are and how it affects their operations, and have made recommendations to me. I am pleased to be joined here by the members of the council and our attorney general. The council, of course, has spoken up loud and clear along with the residents of the District of Columbia, and our attorney general has collaborated with both branches throughout this process. Mr. Attorney General?
Well, since I'm no longer being paid by the word or by the hour, I'll be brief. Every single representation that the mayor has made, and certainly the representations that Council Chairman Mendelson has made, are absolutely accurate and clear. They received advice from their council with respect to Initiative 71. That advice was emphatic, that they were proceeding in a lawful manner, and that indeed, as the mayor indicated, Initiative 71 is, in the Attorney General's office view, law. I would add that the council and the mayor, and certainly the police chief, have acted fully and faithfully in a responsible manner to do what's right, which is to implement the law in a way in which we give guidance to the citizens and residents of the District of Columbia. There's nothing more and there's nothing less. Thanks.
That was Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine at a Wednesday press conference discussing the efforts of Congress to block the recent legalization of marijuana possession in the Capitol.
Pro-Russian rebels and the Ukrainian army have begun pulling back artillery from the front lines, an indication that the German and French brokered truce agreement is being observed. That truce was meant to take effect February 15th, but was undermined by continued fighting between the army and rebel forces, including one of the biggest offensives of the war, the rebel siege and capture of Debaltseve. Both sides alleged violations of the truce, but the Ukrainian army has declared no casualties in the past 2 days, and journalists in the city of Debaltseve reported a complete lack of artillery blasts. Political tensions remain high, though, between the Ukraine and Russia, with President Putin threatening a break in gas supplies to the Ukraine and potentially to parts of Western Europe if the Ukraine does not deliver advance payment on that gas.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, February 26, 2015. Israeli right-wingers set a church on fire in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Israeli troops kidnap civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A group of Israeli fanatics burned on Thursday at dawn a section of the Church of the Domination in occupied Jerusalem, causing significant damage, and wrote racist anti-Christian graffiti on the walls. The fanatics burned a study room belonging to the church, and bathing room, and the toilet rooms used by priests and students of Christian studies. Member of the Fatah Revolutionary Council, Secretary General of the National Christian Assembly in the Holy Land, Dmitry Delyani, said that the attack is just the latest of ongoing cycle of violence targeting Islamic and Christian holy sites in occupied Palestine.
Dilani held the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing extremist coalition government responsible for the escalation of violence, stressing that this attack came approximately 24 hours after Israeli fanatics burned a mosque in Jaba village west of Bethlehem and wrote racist anti-Islamic and anti-Arab graffiti. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Thursday at dawn five Palestinians near the central West Bank city of Ramallah and one near the northern West Bank city of Jenin after the soldiers stormed several homes and searched them. In the central West Bank district of Ramallah, soldiers invaded Deir Abu Mish'al village west of the city and kidnapped five Palestinians after searching their homes. Media sources in Jenin said that several military vehicles invaded Yamun town west of Jenin, kidnapped one Palestinian and handed another a military order for interrogation. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, February 26, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Martin, Paul Rowland, Robin Ryan, Molly Campbell, Eric Takeoff, and Doug McVeigh. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer, keeping all of this running smoothly, is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Solderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, One Land, Many Voices presents excerpts from Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. A panel discussion on international resistance is held this week in Portland. At 10,